Hello and welcome back to I Swear I Never, the podcast where we talk to ordinary people who find themselves in extraordinary situations, situations they swear they never could have predicted.
Every week we have a different theme, and this week's theme is perspective. Beck spoke to Dan, a man who took himself all the way to the top of Mount Everest just to get a bit of perspective, which seems like too far, but hey, I'm not Dan. But before we get into that, who are you?
I'm Beck Day. Who are you?
I'm Nina Young, and that's my perspective.
So here's a question for you. How frequently in recent times have you had your perspective shifted? And has that been something you've sought out yourself, or has it been the result of an unexpected shock?
I try to remain open to changing my perspectives whenever I can. But I think the biggest changes come through those sort of shocks that you're not expecting. I think often it can sort of take you unawares. So I know I've told you about this before, but I spent a few months working in various needle and syringe centres around Sydney. So I was handing out clean syringes to people who need them. I was going and cleaning up dirty syringes from around the town, which I actually really enjoyed. It's quite a zen activity, just wandering around with a bucket and those little grabbers.
Yeah. If you enjoy knitting, just wait.
You could clean up dirty syringes. I thought, yeah, because it's kind of like it's like a little hunt. You got to look around somewhere where you know people would inject drugs and try and guess where they would inject them. And you go, oh, in that corner. Oh, yes, there's a big pile of syringes. I was right. So, I found that fun. Most people don't, but that's fine. Someone's got to find it fun. So when I was working at that place, I went in there with a really preconceived notion of what people in active drug addiction would look like and who they would be and what socioeconomic class they were. And I was pretty, you don't go in there consciously knowing that you have that bias, but it is just there, right? So I got there and one day this guy came in and he was in a really, really nice suit, and he walked up to the counter where I was, and I could see on his keychain he had a BMW keychain, and I was like, wow, this guy must either work here, or he must be management or big boss of this place, or he's lost and he needs directions, or, sometimes people would walk in there and they'd mistake it for something else. So that's what I thought was happening. And he was like, oh, hey, I've got a bucket of syringes that I need cleaned up from my house, and I know you guys do a pickup service sometimes. Can you come and get this large bucket of syringes?
Oh.
And I was like, sorry, syringes for, and he's like, heroin. Yeah, heroin.
Just a lot of heroin. A
lot of heroin. Yeah, he actually told me he was writing a PhD in debauchery.
Oh.
So I don't know if he's written it. I'll read it.
Real gonzo stuff.
I went to his house and did pick up a large bucket of syringes. That was true. But it immediately gave me this perspective of you don't know. You can't recognize what people are doing, or, you can't just look at someone and know something about them. That's what that taught me. Yeah.
Well, and I think it's both the realization and the shock of that realization. It's kind of the emotional or mental, I can be wrong about something, or I hadn't considered it from that perspective. And I would say that also you in particular are someone that I look to for guidance, I guess, or inspiration on how it is so important to always put yourself in somebody else's shoes or try and understand the other perspective. I know that, a lot of the QAnon stuff and the anti-vax stuff that was going on, especially mid last year, you were one of the only people I knew who sought to really understand the other side by just simply, spending time on forums and chat boards and Reddit places where those kind of people hang out. And it doesn't necessarily mean, obviously, that you are going to go down that political route. But I definitely always, I think that you're someone that always seeks out that alternate perspective.
Yeah, I see value in knowing what what the other side is thinking. I definitely don't agree with those people. You know, I'm not hanging out with anti-vaxxers and chatting with them and going, oh, yeah, I see where you're coming from. Good point. I'm not, and I probably won't.
Probably not, but sharing drinks.
But I do think there's value in opening yourself up beyond your echo chamber, because when we get stuck in these echo chambers, that's when things like Trump happen. Because you don't understand what's happening outside your echo chamber and you just get taken by surprise. So I do think we need to be more aware, more open to different new perspectives, and just listen a little bit more, I think, in general.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I think even going into my chat with Daniel, who has an amazing story to tell, not only about summiting Everest, but about nearly losing his life and the massive experience that shifted his perspective while he was up there. But when I first asked him about why he even wanted to start, you know, what got him excited about climbing and heights, he didn't say that it was about the challenge or it was about the goal or it was about pushing himself. He said that quite simply, as a young child, he liked the different perspective he got when he was up high looking down at the world, because everything looked different from up there. And I thought, wow, what a profound and also very simple reason for why you would want to push yourself outside of your comfort zone like that. Yeah. And anyway, I think that you're going to get a lot out of this. I think if you are anything like me, you will be wildly surprised at the way you actually do climb Everest. It's not, spoiler, you don't just get dropped by a helicopter and make your way up in a little day trip.
Oh, I'm out.
Yeah, I know. I was like, oh, so it's not for me then.
I'm keen to hear it. So let's get into it. Hold on. I got to press stop. Don't get ahead of yourself.
Daniel Bull has been obsessed with heights for as long as he can remember.
I do have memories of just climbing trees, you know, and always climbing trees and having my views were more, instead of looking up, looking down on all the action. And I think I found myself on the roof of the house on occasion.
And while the thrill is a huge pull, there's something else that spurs him forward.
And I think, a big part of it was the thrill of the climb, but also getting like different perspectives on things.
That perspective Dan's chasing has delivered some of the most course-altering lessons over the years, including one that saved his life. But we'll get to that. For now, let's go back to when Dan was at school, first discovering the fact that a mountain called Everest existed.
Yeah, so I actually remember seeing some old footage of the Himalayas and Mount Everest in particular on TV after school one day. And it showed all these black and white images of climbers getting stuck and struggling against the elements. And at first I thought, oh my gosh, why would anyone do that? But it also sparked something in me. And I remember wondering, what if I could reach the highest point on the planet? And I think that idea or that possibility really captured my imagination.
By his own admission, Dan was a kid and teenager who needed a strong goal to keep him focused. That's exactly what the dream of summiting Everest did. Before long, he was spending a lot of time rock climbing and trying to learn the skills he'd need for his mission.
I didn't just kind of wake up and say, okay, let's head to Everest. So, you know, I knew I couldn't go straight from quite literally sea level all the way up to almost 9,000 metres above where we are right now. And so I started, like you said, with rock climbing. And then that moved into tracking down some frozen waterfalls to learn ice climbing. And then, you know, pulling all the pieces together. I have to point out, I still went to school, you know, and got a job and all that. But I basically juggled that for years and years while I quite literally learned the ropes.
The more time Dan spent inside at university, the bigger his dream loomed. He began climbing different peaks around the world, learning everything he could about the process and developing an idea of how he wanted to go about it.
And I also learned that there are different ways of climbing a mountain, you know, like Everest. Just like there are different approaches to doing most things in life, right? And for me, I wanted the rewards of climbing the mountain unguided. You know, instead of paying a guiding company a ton of money to try to haul me up there, there was an experienced mountaineer at the time that we met during an earlier climb. And he said, "Daniel, you could be the youngest person in the world to climb Everest." At the time, I was maybe 23 or 24. And like I said, I think it was, you know, for me, I've realized quite early on that it's important not just what you do, but how you do it. And look, in hindsight, I maybe could have gone for it, but I didn't quite feel ready.
In the end, it was an encounter on another mountain that finally signaled Dan's readiness.
And I really didn't want to be a burden on other climbers and put other people's life at risk, which unfortunately, you know, you do encounter on Everest. People that rock up, maybe they've got a lot of money and they're happy to hand that over and, you know, have people help carry their gear and learn as they go. And maybe they get away with it. You know, maybe they get lucky, but at what cost? So, I really wanted to prepare as meticulously as possible. And so that's where I set myself some other milestones along the way. And I remember helping rescue an American that reached the highest point in South America, but passed out. And I remember helping a local guide lower him down on a rope, thinking, okay, I think I'm ready to take the next step and to go for Everest. You know, that the fact that I'd been able to get to the top, hurting, but still strong and was able to help others. I felt like for me, that was, that kind of was a good indicator that I think I was ready.
And so after taking out his very first bank loan, Daniel booked a flight to the Himalayas.
And so we actually, there was a team of us, a group of Aussies and a Brit, and we all pooled our resources together. So, you know, we shared base camp facilities, but ultimately what happens is, as opposed to maybe more standard alpine climbing where you're roped up on Everest, you're not actually connected to your teammates. So you actually, even though you have a plan and you set up camps together, you actually spread out. And so often, you do find yourself climbing pretty much alone on the mountain.
Don't go anywhere. We're going to be right back after this short break. Now, here's something I didn't know about climbing Everest. Spoiler, there is a lot I don't know about climbing Everest. But actually, it turns out that you don't just somehow catch a helicopter to base camp and start hiking.
So, you know, Kosciuszko is just over 2,000 metres. So if you double that and then add a bit more, 5,500 metres is typically where Everest base camp will be set up. And, you know, even though it's at the base of the mountain before the serious climb really begins, I remember arriving feeling like death. Like I literally stumbled into camp. You know, I was nauseous. I had this shocking headache. It was like I was getting kicked in the head by a horse repeatedly. And I wondered how on earth I was going to be able to go any higher. But base camp is, you know, that quite literally is your home for the next 2 months.
That's right. Once Dan was at base camp, it was a matter of tackling the mountain bite by bite. For 2 months, Dan and his team stretched themselves a little bit further each day, pushing themselves higher with each exploratory hike before returning back to base camp.
And there are two reasons for that approach. The first is, you know, you've got to carry all your gear and stock each camp with supplies for the eventual summit push, right? But then also, and this is a big one, you need to acclimatize to the thin air. So our bodies are just not used to having that thin, rarefied air. And so everything you do from, you know, from just crawling out of your tent at base camp to walking around, to going to the toilet, even your digestive system, it actually starts grinding to a halt. It just starts slowing down. So, you know, you can imagine you're investing, you're exerting more energy and effort than you've ever done before. And yet because of the digestive system slowing down, you actually don't, your body doesn't, it's struggling to eat. And so you've kind of almost got to force feed yourself. You know, you're drinking maybe 5 liters of water a day just to be hydrated enough to be able to keep moving.
It was a hard slog, and one that, while it became more familiar, never really got easier.
You do acclimatize, but you are pretty much pushing the limits on a regular basis and, you know, constantly kind of stepping out of your comfort zone. Because like I said, even though I didn't just rock up to Everest, you know, I put in the training and preparation, and I tried to get as much experience as possible in on other mountains around the world before heading deep into the remote Himalayas. I was breaking a lot of personal records. You know, each day after a certain point, I was going higher than I'd ever been before.
Eventually, after weeks at base camp and countless years beforehand of preparation, the day arrived to set out for what's called a summit push, the day Dan and his team would attempt to get to the very top of Mount Everest.
The first obstacle is the icefall. It's called the Khumbu Icefall. And it's a maze of these constantly shifting ice blocks. Some are, just to give you an idea, some are as large as small cars. Others are as big as 10-story buildings, which, by the way, could randomly break off at any time. And as you can imagine, I felt like just an ant, you know, kind of crawling, making my way through these ice giants. And at the same time, you can really feel the vibrations of avalanches crashing around you. And then you've got to cross countless crevasses. So there's really like 100 ways you can die up there. And, you know, and you're facing ongoing risk and uncertainty on a daily basis. After weeks into the expedition, we move on up to Camp 4, which is located on the South Col. So this is high camp. I remember I was the last one to arrive into camp, which is never a good feeling. It's quite late in the day. And so I just crawled into the tent, trying not to wake up the other guys. Because I think it would just be a matter of hours by this point when we'd make that final summit push.
Daniel tried to get some sleep to prepare for the journey ahead.
I knew it was going to be bloody tough just to survive the day ahead. You know, I was laying in the tent. It's about 8,000 metres above sea level. You're actually inside what's known as the death zone. So that's the cruising altitude of a commercial airliner. So at this height, the air is actually suffocating. You know, you're on borrowed time.
After managing a few hours of sleep, Dan woke up late, which put him immediately on the back foot.
And I found myself at the very end of this line of climbers. You know, every climber hoping to reach the top that day were clipped into the rope ahead of me. And, you know, I've never really enjoyed waiting around in queues, especially when it's minus 40 degrees outside and it's in the middle of the night. And so, yeah, I quickly realized that, you know, this was not the time to be waiting around. You know, this was the moment I'd worked so hard for. And so I made a bold call to unclip from the rope, which isn't recommended. And I started climbing. I took a few steps over to the right and I started climbing alone through the dark.
In the pitch darkness, completely alone, Dan continued his ascent. He climbed and he climbed and then he climbed some more, all the while pushing for the dream he'd sparked up when he was still a kid in school. Finally, something he recognised loomed before him.
And what felt like an endless amount of hours later, without drinking, you know, you're not eating or even peeing, just taking step after step, I found myself looking up at the Hillary Step.
Named for Sir Edmund Hillary, who was one of the first known climbers to reach the summit of Mount Everest, the Hillary Step was a near vertical 12-metre high rock face covered in snow and ice. Climbing it meant facing the 3,000-metre drop that awaited you if you fell. And while it has since been partially destroyed by a 2015 earthquake, it represented the most challenging part of climbing Everest, the final frontier before reaching the summit. Looking up, Dan realised he was almost within reach of his goal. But his mind wasn't at the top of the mountain at that moment. It was back home.
And my dad came to mind. And he'd been such a huge supporter every step of the way. And I started to get a bit emotional. And I don't know how, because I was so dehydrated, but I think I shed a few tears. But I knew I just had to keep moving. And in that moment, the sun rose over Tibet. And I got to see where I was and what was around me.
Daniel had climbed through the night, and after successfully scaling the Hillary Step, he found himself where he dreamed of being for all of those years, at the top of Mount Everest.
And without fully realising it, I'd overtaken almost everyone else on the mountain, including everyone that was on that rope ahead of me. And so it turned out I was one of the first to reach the summit.
Now, I don't know about you, but I had always pictured the top of Mount Everest to be a somewhat deserted place, kind of like, I don't know, the surface of the moon. But as Dan explains, when he got to the top, there are a handful of other climbers up there as well, and more on their way.
You know, it's almost like a zombie apocalypse. People are just moving very slowly, you know, just a lot of breaths to be able to muster the energy to take one step. And so yeah, there was a line of climbers that I actually saw. I didn't see until I started descending that the most of the climbers were still coming up. And so there was just a handful of us. It was really quite incredible.
After snapping a couple of obligatory pics, Dan sat down and just let the momentous occasion sink in.
And, you know, that summit euphoria was very quickly replaced by a deep sense of dread. Because I'm only halfway. You know, I've still got to get down this thing. And I've done my research and I knew that 80% of the accidents and fatalities occur on the descent.
Trying to pick your way down a mountain while a line of determined hikers is making their way up is a whole other exercise in logistics, Dan explains.
So I kind of had to negotiate on a very, like a knife edge ridge as they're going up and very focused. I'm now trying to get down. So I'm kind of negotiating my way around them. And then I find myself completely alone. You know, I'm still high on the mountain, but I'm just completely exhausted.
It wasn't just the climb that had Dan so depleted. There were a few health issues going on that added an extra layer of complexity.
It didn't help that I actually suffered chronic childhood asthma that was making it even harder to breathe in the thin air. And I'd been diagnosed before I set off for Everest with Raynaud's phenomenon.
Raynaud's phenomenon is a problem with limited circulation in the fingers and toes, precisely the kind of medical issue you don't want to face when you're climbing at altitude through ice and snow.
You know, so I learned that actually skyrockets the risk of frostbite in the cold, especially at high altitude where the body's lacking oxygen. And so it's struggling to produce more red blood cells. And so, you know, I couldn't feel my toes at this point. And my fingers were in immense pain. They were like frozen ice popsicles. You know, and that probably really scared me. more than the toes, because without my fingers, I'd be useless. And I finally gave in to the urge to have a breather.
And who could blame him? But it turns out taking a breather at this point in the game is a dangerous move.
So I leaned back into this steep snow slope. And I did know that people had sat down before, never to get up again. But I didn't care. You know, I just felt this warmth come over me. And I felt myself drifting off. You know, I was completely at peace.
Dan wasn't just resting. He was dying. His reserves depleted, still inside the dead zone. He knew that if he fell asleep, he was unlikely to wake up again. But at that point, he didn't really care. Until, that is, something caught his attention.
And then I spot another climber out of the corner of my eye. And I could see the colour in his jacket caught my attention. And I just had this huge sense of relief to know that I'm not alone. You know, we get this comfort from being in numbers, and particularly on Everest, I think we all know that there's not a lot we can do for one another, but just not that knowledge that there was someone else with me made a huge difference.
Buoyed by having company, Daniel stole another glance at his companion and noticed something else.
And then I do a double take and I realise that he was covered with a thin layer of ice. He'd likely been there, you know, for a very long time.
The climber next to Daniel wasn't just taking a breather either. He'd died on the mountain, possibly years before, perfectly preserved in the icy temperatures.
I think there's over 200, there's been over 200 deaths on Everest. And no one's, you know, exactly sure where the bodies are, but just because of the, you know, the extreme conditions and the rugged terrain. So I knew there were bodies on the mountain, but it's the one thing I never could have predicted was meeting this ice-covered climber on the mountain and him playing a big role in helping me avoid the same fate.
When someone dies on Everest, it's generally accepted that the risk to others in retrieving their body is too great, and so they're mostly left on the mountain forever. But looking at the dead climber sparked something deep in Daniel's exhausted, depleted body.
You know, instead of adding to the body count on Everest, which I really think I was just moments away from, I realised I didn't want to suffer the same fate. You know, I wanted to see my family again. And all of a sudden, I had a new purpose and motivation. And I knew I had to get up and keep moving. So it was kind of like jet fuel. You know, it was something that had just been injected into me that lifted me to my feet and propelled me downwards.
Back on his feet, Daniel kept slogging his way back down the mountain. He knew what waited for him if he stopped to rest again, and it wasn't a fate he was ready for. And so he kept going and going.
I think it was a couple of days. You know, so you actually crash back into the tent at high camp. You're not there for too long, but you just, again, you need to recover. And then you just kind of make your way back down the Lhotse face. You get back down to camp two, and that's the first point where you realize, shit, I think I've survived Everest. And you start to relax a little bit, but then you've still got to make your way back through the icefall one more time. Now, if you remember the icefall, that's where you've got these shifting, moving, giant skyscraper-sized ice blocks. And people have likened crossing the icefall to playing Russian roulette, that each time you go through, you know, it's just a huge amount of risk. So I knew I could do it. It was just that final passage back to the relief of base camp.
We're going to have a quick break and we're going to be right back after that. Once he was safe back at base camp, Dan had one more job to do.
And I actually got to make one of the best phone calls ever. I used the team satellite phone to call my dad. To let him know that I was alive, and at the same time, to wish him a happy birthday.
And what about the dead climber? Did Daniel ever try to figure out who he was when he returned to sea level?
I think I knew that I didn't want to take a photo of him. And I know that other climbers have done that and I've, you know, shared them in the media. And I think for me, like always, you know, it's about respecting the mountain, the local people that you encounter and also your fellow climbers. And I just didn't feel right. So whilst I have the memories, I didn't have that photo that I could have shared, you know, that would have helped me identify him. I know that the role they played in, you know, in my journey and my survival, and I'm grateful for that. The one thing I do know is that my other teammates, you know, again, they were a lot more experienced than I was at the time. They'd already attempted Everest. They were pushed back by a storm. They did actually lose one of their teammates high on the mountain. So that is a possibility that it was him. But I just don't know.
Having come face to face with death on the mountain, Dan's perspective was forever changed.
It's been quite incredible. The lessons that I've learned really apply quite directly to the challenges that I face at sea level. And so whenever I'm encountering a challenge or a setback or a perceived failure or I've got that same self-doubt that I had on Everest, I'm able to go back and think, okay, well, what did I do in that situation? I think grit and resilience is a big part of it. But also having a compelling motivation and purpose. So, yeah, it's interesting. Everyone often asks about, you know, how I managed to get to the top of Everest. No one ever asks about what happens next, you know, once you've achieved your goal or you know, you've reached the summit. And like I mentioned, I was lucky. I'd reached the summit on my first attempt. You know, as a result, I no longer had that driving force, you know, that vision of where I was headed. In reaching the summit, all of that had just vanished, you know. And so coming back to the descent, you know, I was stumbling almost aimlessly back down the mountain. And so I've learned that it starts with having the courage to dream big and defining a compelling vision of your summit. But on top of that, setting ongoing milestones and goals that propel you forwards. Yeah, and I don't think it's always about a specific destination. I think when I was younger, that was definitely what it was about. It was getting to the top at all costs. But I think having, you know, continued climbing and pushing my limits, I've realized more that it's about continuing your journey.
A massive thank you to Dan for sharing his story. And if you want to catch up with what Dan is up to, including his motivational speaking schedule, you can check him out at his website, which is unstoppable.com. And that is spelled UNSTOPPABULL. That's unstoppable with a bull at the end. And if you have ever found yourself in a situation you swear you never could have predicted, we want to hear all about it. Please email us. Please email us with any of your wild and crazy stories. You would be amazed at how many amazing stories we hear from people just down the pub who don't think they have a story to tell and then realise that they do. So email us. You can get us at isin@news.com.au. We're also over on Instagram where you can find us at ISIN Podcast. Please give us a follow there as well. We are going to be back next week with another episode. And until then, I hope your life is filled with only good things.